This is the 2020 Statehouse Podcast, brought to you by South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Funding is brought to you in part by SDN Communications, the South Dakota Bar Foundation, Missouri River Energy Services, and Touchstone Energy Cooperatives. Here's Chris Loffrey with today's top legislative news in Pierre.
The Council for Higher Education, or COHE, is continuing contract negotiations with the Board of Regents, even after a bill banning collective bargaining for public faculty passes the State House. COHE is a branch of the South Dakota Education Association, which advocates on behalf of educators at all levels. Mary McCorkle is the president of that organization. She says changes will come, but negotiations continue.
There is collective bargaining until when laws go into effect in South Dakota. We'll continue to represent our members and bargain a contract in good faith with the Board of Regents.
Proponents of the new ban say less than 10% of eligible faculty are dues-paying members for a union that negotiates contracts for all. Opponents say because South Dakota is a right-to-work state, faculty aren't forced to pay dues in order to benefit from union negotiations and mediation. McCorkle says COHE will still have contacts on campuses after the new law goes into effect, but non-members may no longer have access to their representation.
If there is not collective bargaining, when the contract expires, we will be the voice for our members.
Governor Noem supports the ban on faculty collective bargaining and is expected to sign the bill when it reaches her desk.
Jackie Hendry is with us here in the Kirby Family Studio at SDPB's Sioux Falls Studio. Hey, Jackie, welcome back.
Hey, Lori, thanks for having me.
Stephanie Rissler is in the South Dakota Public Broadcasting Studios in Vermilion on the campus of the University of South Dakota. Welcome back, Stephanie.
Thank you, Lori.
Seth Tupper is at the press conference right now. Lee Strubinger is at the press conference right now and will be with us in a minute. And Seth Tupper is joining us from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital Studio in SDPB's Black Hills Studio. Seth, welcome back.
Hi, Lori.
Let's start with education. Let's start with Jackie Hendry here in Sioux Falls. Jackie, some of the big news about education this year is still unfolding, and Seth has some stuff on that as well. But let's start with collective bargaining for Board of Regents employees, a ban on that. Where do you want to begin?
Well, we'll start with this isn't the first time that the State House has attempted to ban collective bargaining for Board of Regents employees, specifically those six public universities in our state. In 2017, the legislature banned collective bargaining for the state's technical colleges. That has continued. And as for those state universities, former Speaker of the House Mark Mickelson brought a very similar bill to what we saw this year in 2018, which failed very narrowly in the Senate, which was its final hurdle in that year. This year, or I should say the reasoning then was very similar to the reasoning we saw this session, that removing the collective bargaining piece will make universities more nimble, almost word for word, the kind of same argument we're hearing this year. Two bills this year with the same intent. One came out of the Senate and one came out of the House, and the Senate bill passed first.
All right, let's talk about the arguments for removing collective bargaining.
Right. Senate Majority Leader Chris Langer was the prime sponsor of the Senate bill this year. And in her introduction of the bill, she spent quite a few minutes highlighting what this bill is not intended to do in her focus, and namely that it's not intended to be anti-faculty or anti-higher education.
To the contrary, this bill seeks to enhance the ability of our universities to compete in a competitive and ever-changing market by removing the barrier of the bargaining process and affording our universities the flexibility to adjust to the changing market in a timely and efficient fashion and to provide for the future workforce needs of our state.
So Langer and other proponents, which, by the way, included a representative from the governor's office, arguing that the contract process is cumbersome. It locks policies in for 3 years at a time and keeps institutions kind of behind in maybe some growing trends in higher education. Also, proponents say that dues paying members in the faculty union is actually quite small. We're looking at less than 10% of eligible faculty are paying members of the union. So their argument being that that's a very small proportion proportion of faculty members making decisions on behalf of everyone.
And also indicative that there might not be the opposition to it in some ways. If 90% of your faculty are not engaged enough to pay dues, they might not fight against the removal of it, in theory.
In theory.
In theory. All right. So have other states done this?
Yes. Texas, North Carolina, Virginia, Georgia, all of them have outright banned collective bargaining for their public institutions. And a handful of others, like Iowa and Wisconsin, have significantly stepped back those bargaining abilities. So while it has been done, it still puts South Dakota in the minority in the country to do this. And opponents of this bill pointed out that those states who have banned collective bargaining tend to pay their professors quite a bit more and offer state funding to a greater degree than South Dakota tends to.
All right. Let's talk about the arguments against it. These are the folks who want to keep the right to collectively bargain in the state for those universities.
Right. So I want to give some backstory for the lobbyist I'm about to introduce. So we made that point about low paying membership. And in fact, the Council of Higher Education, or COHE, that's the faculty union, is so small that it's actually a unit of the South Dakota Education Association, which also works with K-12 education. And SDEA lobbyist Jeremiah Murphy testified against these bills, and he says this law isn't the avenue the proponents think it is.
Unions in South Dakota cannot, in South Dakota public schools, public colleges and universities, cannot negotiate salaries or benefits, cannot go to binding arbitration, they cannot strike, and they're subject to South Dakota's right to work law. Now, that right to work law is interesting because in this case it's working, and that seems to bother the proponents.
And by that he means because people aren't forced to pay union dues in unionized spaces in South Dakota, that's, he believes, the reason why we're not seeing more than 10% of faculty paying into the union. And as we've already said, most are not. He also adds that eliminating COHE eliminates a mechanism for faculty to resolve or mediate conflicts without jumping immediately to administrative or Board of Regents levels. It's kind of that middle ground to take care of some of these things. And we heard similar arguments from other opponents of this bill, who many were former members or current members of COHE.
All right. So to be clear, even though they are not paying the dues, they're still benefiting.
Exactly.
The decisions made during those negotiations are valid for all the employees.
Yes.
All right. So that's for clarity. Now, without the union, how do those policy changes happen then?
Right. So that question came up in Senate State Affairs. Nathan Lucas is the general counsel for the Board of Regents. He didn't necessarily testify one way or the other. No representatives from the Board of Regents testified one way or the other on either of these bills, as far as I've known. But as for how Board of Regents policy then changes without that collective bargaining bid, including hiring policies, things like this, here was his response.
Board policy can be changed at a board meeting, which would require a majority vote of the members present. Typically, our default rule is there's a two-reading policy, so it would have to come before the board at two different meetings, but there is an exception where in extenuating circumstances, a policy can be changed in one reading with a unanimous vote of the board.
So that Senate bill passed to the governor's desk. She is expected to sign it. What happened with the House bill, Jackie?
So once the Senate bill passed its final rung on the House floor, that next morning during committee, Senator Langer moved to amend the House bill to say simply, education in South Dakota is hereby enhanced. So a hog house amendment, more or less communicating that the intention has made it through the other bill and there we
Our
go.
Our work here is done.
Yeah.
Right. What happens next?
So reminder that COHE is a unit of South Dakota Education Association, and I spoke with SDEA President Mary McCorkle late last week. She says negotiations for the current contract are still ongoing with the Board of Regents until this law goes into effect this summer.
There is collective bargaining until when laws go into effect in South Dakota. We'll continue to represent our members and bargain a contract in good faith with the Board of Regents.
And she adds, COHE reps will remain on campuses, but if collective bargaining is not reinstated by the time this upcoming contract expires, then those COHE reps would begin only working with dues-paying members. Because again, right now, they'll work with anyone, dues-paying members or not. That will change in the future. So for non-COHE members who may have gone through mediation or other processes with COHE, that wouldn't necessarily be available to them anymore without membership once this bill goes through.
But it is available to them with membership?
Yes.
Okay. All right. We're going to hear more about that in the future, I'm sure. Governor Kristi Noem is expected to sign that. Let's keep talking about education, specifically school bond elections, and bring Seth Tupper into the conversation from our studios in Rapid City. Seth, this is a really interesting story about the school bond elections, and it kind of gets back to this idea that Jackie just sort of brought up about changing a bill's language as the political process goes on. Set this up for us so people who haven't been following this understand the context.
Yeah, so this is really tied up in local politics out here in Rapid City that sort of tumbled into the legislature this year. And on February 25th, we had a a school bond election here in Rapid City, and it was for $190 million to build or renovate multiple buildings. It needed 60% support to pass, and it only got 56%. So it ended up failing. Nevertheless, some of the people in the Vote No group thought that their vote was suppressed by the fact that the school board had scheduled the election for the middle of the winter on February 25th. And we did, in fact, have 13 inches of snow the night before and morning of the election. And that kind of added more fodder to that argument about voter suppression. So Representative Tim Goodwin, responding to those concerns by the Vote No group, brought a bill that would have required school bond elections to only be held in June or November on more traditional election dates. And that actually passed a House committee and the full House last month. And then on Thursday, the bill was up in a Senate committee, and Representative Goodwin showed up and sort of inexplicably, and to the surprise apparently of many of the senators in the room, asked for the bill to be basically wholly replaced with new language. And that new language sought to require a 30% voter turnout for a school bond election to be valid. And that, too, was tied up in local politics because the turnout in Rapid City was only 23%. And so the senators in the room, several expressed surprise and actually said they were ready to vote for the previous version of the bill. But nevertheless, they said to Goodwin, if this is what you want, we'll amend your bill and then we'll debate it. So they amended it and debated it. And Tim Goodwin testified. He didn't offer much explanation on why he asked for the amendment, but here's what he did have to say.
Basically, we're not dictating, and I did have a lot of heat before on the old version of the bill that we're taking control away from the local level by saying you only could have an election in June and November. This way here, they got 365 days, except leap year, they got 366 to pick the date.
And so, yeah, he didn't say much more
than
that.
Yeah, I'm processing that because I'm not sure he's answering the question. No. Well, he kind of is.
The other thing he said just briefly was that apparently a lot of people had approached him in private and said that, you know, if you only give two times a year for schools to have bond elections, that's going to throw off their budgeting process and the timing wouldn't work very well. So he must have gotten enough pressure that he decided to do this. So they did amend the bill.
So he could just withdraw it, though, couldn't he have?
Could have, yeah.
Could have.
But
Hawkhouse didn't sit. Do you know the history of the word Hawkhouse, why it's called Hawkhousing?
Yeah. Basically that there was a bill many, many decades ago apparently to erect or build, I think, a hog house at, I think, South Dakota State University. And that came in late and as a replacement for another bill that had a different subject. So there ever after they called doing this kind of thing, replacing a bill with entirely with new language.
So it's unique to South Dakota. Not the process, but the term.
Yeah, the term.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, but he didn't withdraw it. He hoghassed it, changed it to this 30% voter turnout being necessary. That, what would have happened if that had passed? What do we put that into context as a piece of legislation for us, Seth?
And that was what some of the testimony against the new form of the bill was about. And one of the people who testified on that was Rob Monson, who's an executive director of the School Administrators of South Dakota. And he said that there could be some absurd situations set up by a bill like this. And here's what he had to say about that.
I would ask you, if this law were to pass and we had a bond election on some capital outlay certificates and we had 25% of the people show up for this election, but they voted 100% in favor of the project. What do we say to that? We'd say, sorry, folks, we know we need this in our schools. We know we need this in our community, but we only got 25%, even though you were all in favor of it. We have to reject this.
Seth, do you have any idea what the normal voter turnout is on a sunny day? I mean, you've been following voter turnout in Rapid City in general for some time.
We did have a school opt-out election, kind of similar to a bond election in 2014. And the turnout that year in 2014, the election was in June, and the turnout was higher. I don't recall off the top of my head what exactly the number was. But, you know, turnout's never that great for a single issue election like this was, with only one thing on the ballot, no matter when it is, at what time of year. So, yeah. And that was testimony in a previous on the previous bill as well. There was somebody who testified that, you know, where's the proof that turnout would be any better on any other day than in February? And there was also some humorous testimony in the committee on this particular version of the bill that, you know, if you have election in June, there might be a tornado or there might be a hailstorm. And does that mean you can't have elections in June? Because that would be voter suppression. So
we just gave them an opportunity to talk about the weather in the state legislature and all.
Right.
Will we ever get back to business if we allow this to sort of fantasize about what bad weather might befall us on any given day in South Dakota?
Exactly. And I should say, just to wrap it up, So the committee gave Representative Goodwin his wish, and they amended the bill and debated it, and then they promptly defeated it 6-0 after it had already passed the House, and after several of them said, you know, I was ready to vote for the other version of your bill, but I can't vote for this.
That's interesting. That's just a good story. All right. You're also still following this exhaustive study of the university system. Where are we at on that as we wrap up this first segment, just really with education topics?
So that bill is still alive. It has passed the Senate and the House committee, and I'm assuming it'll get action by the House this week.
Yeah. Tim Goodwin's an interesting lawmaker to follow, I think. With his online presence, too, he asks a lot of questions and hears from a lot of constituents. He's really, I think all the lawmakers are, but he's had some interesting conversations with people online who disagree with him in his county. And to watch him bring that into the state house when it's against his own, his own beliefs is interesting to watch how politics works in the state, I think. So we're turning the final corner here for the state legislative session. And Lee Strubinger was just at a press briefing from Governor Kristi Noem, and he joins us now from the Rapid City studio. Lee, what did you learn?
Well, I just got off the press conference call, and Noem held a press conference with legislative leadership in the governor's press room, and also with the chair of appropriations. She basically outlined this. She said the state is seeing stronger revenues, and that in her budget, she said she wanted additional revenues to go to the big three, which is state employees, education, and providers. And based on conversations that happened over the weekend, they plan on funding state employees, providers, and education at a 2% increase is what those three will get. You know, she says there are three primary reasons why the state is able to do that. She says they're seeing stronger revenue collections since December. The state is seeing less utilization of social programs within the Department of Social Services, which she says will get plugged into this increase. And she also says the state will put a pause on increasing the state repair and maintenance budget.
Say that last part again, a pause on what?
On basically state repair and maintenance for state facilities and those sorts of things. She made it sound like generally there's a bit of an increase that goes towards that budget. And it sounds like they're going to put a pause on that increase and plug those dollars into the big three.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Did she mention at all during the press conference when we talk about revenues being higher than as we look at other states and the economic impact of, you know, a virus panic and what that could do to a state's economy? Did she mention anything about that at all from an economic standpoint?
No mention of anything resembling a coronavirus outbreak type stuff. I don't know if legislators are considering that at this point. She was asked about the state's response to coronavirus. It doesn't sound like there's much of an update to that from over the weekend. And she still says that the state is seeing a low risk for that kind of outbreak here at this point.
And we have no confirmed or suspected cases in the state of South Dakota at this point. So that's just a reminder and an update for listeners. And Lee, I want to go back and wrap up with you a little bit. We were talking about the conditional use permits earlier. and sort of the things that the Senate Bill 157 would do. And I wanted to ask you what Governor Noem's sort of response was to that. Did she weigh in on that argument at all?
Well, one of the arguments has been about local control. And so, you know, in the case of this bill, she says that local control is not impacted. And the key reason why local control is not impacted, she says, is because counties can still determine their own setbacks.
They can decide what they want their setbacks to be. They can decide what kind of odor control they want to have. They can decide their noise control levels. Every county still gets to do that. This bill does not touch any of those decisions. What it says is if somebody wants to apply for a conditional use permit, there's a time frame for when a decision has to be made. If somebody wants to appeal that, it defines who can be aggrieved and the time frame for when that appeal needs to be issued and determined.
So you're hearing from people that that's going to be a key for counties to really look at what their setbacks and such are.
Yeah. The thing I'm hearing now from some county officials is that they're going to take a step back. Now that this bill is in play, they're going to take a step back and look at their setbacks and see if it's enough.
So, Stephanie Ristler, I want to bring you into this conversation because earlier on this program, we talked about confined animal feeding operations in particular, and really that tied into this notion of international trade, where hogs are going, where products are going from farmers across the globe. And this is something that you have been following in peer as well, correct?
There has been some discussion about urging state leaders, specifically our Governor's Office of Economic Development, to be more aggressive when it comes to international trade. And when you look at our state, 70% of our state's economy comes from ag. 40% of that is in exports. But when you look at where we sit in terms of international trade, it's more at that. We actually rank 50th in the nation. So it's an interesting conversation. Yeah.
All right. So tell us a little bit about efforts to move that forward in peer.
There was an attempt earlier this session to create a law that would have created the International Trade Office within the Governor's Office of Economic Development. Representative Michael Saba, he is from Hartford, and he has been very vocal over the last year. He would like to see more efforts for our state to look at international opportunities. So he tried to bring a bill. It was heard in committee, and it died in committee on a 9-4 vote. Lawmakers, they did applaud him and said, this is a great step in starting the conversation, but it died. So last week, Representative Saba tried to do something a little bit different, not necessarily a bill, but a resolution that urges the Governor's Office of Economic Development to promote more international business and trade on behalf of South Dakota on a statewide level. And as I mentioned, we rank 50th in the nation. And according to Saba, that's just not acceptable.
So there's no reason we should be that low in the international trade. We have a state office of trade in the Governor's Office of Economic Development, and this resolution essentially is urging the office to be more assertive in its work on international trade.
Stephanie, that did not go forward. So tell me a little bit about what Representative Saba had to say about what else is happening in the country that we need to keep our eyes open to.
Well, during some of that conversation on this concurrent resolution, lawmakers had a lot of questions to ask. Again, this is a resolution. It's not a law, so it's non-binding. But, you know, they wanted to know, what does it look like for our neighboring states? How well are they doing on that international trade level? And this was his response.
North Dakota, with much of the same products, is 32nd in international trade. Nebraska's ahead of us, Iowa's ahead of us, with similar products. Now, some might say, well, North Dakota has oil. Well, even if you take the oil out of their international trade, they would be 35th.
And not everyone thinks that looking toward international trade should be our first focus either.
Well, as you were talking with Lee earlier, when it comes to those in the hog industry, Representative Caleb Fink, he's from Tripp, South Dakota, stood up and said, look, we need to pay more attention to what's going on locally, give our efforts and our support to those local farmers, because according to Fink, trading is being done more locally. They are bringing more economy in at the local level than anything we are seeing internationally.
We have been putting up hog barns in my area like crazy. And when I say literally the hogs are chewing through all this corn, that's quite figuratively and literally what's going on. And there is such a demand for corn because of the local influence in our market. That's what's driven this. Last summer, we saw positive corn basis probably for the first time in my life ever. And that's not because of international trade. That's because of local trade and what local dollars are doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting debate there. That's tying in pretty tightly to what we've been talking about all show,
absolutely.
Really. Yeah.
And it was adopted on a very high number. 57 folks, lawmakers said, yes, let's approve this. It made it to committee, passed unanimously, and now it will be debated on the Senate floor later today. And like I said, it's a resolution, so it is different than a law, but it does have that conversation started about South Dakota finding a place at the table when it comes to international trade.
All right. Lee Strubinger, give us a little bit of an idea of some of the other things that are still left to discuss. What has Governor Noem said about funding a hemp program, for example?
Right. So in addition to the increase for the big three that she announced, she also says that the state will be funding the hemp program at one of her guardrail levels, which is the full $3.6 million. Recall, if you will, that the governor and the legislature were at complete odds in terms of how a hemp program will be funded. She wanted funding to go to the Department of Ag, Department of Health, and Department of Public Safety. The legislature pretty much only had money going to the Department of Ag to respond to hemp getting legalized in the state. And the legislature even said that it would cost about 5% of that $3.6 million that she suggested. So Noem now says that funding for everything, including the big three and this hemp program, was the result of a lot of conversations with legislators over the weekend. And so now appropriators will work through the final budget and put some of those numbers together, and we'll see what comes out on Thursday.
So is the heavy lifting on those negotiations for the budget, is that now, that phase is over?
It would seem so. And I asked that similar question to Governor Noem and some of the leadership. And it seems like the House and Senate still have some differing opinions on some one-time spending that still might be out there. But other than that, the big budget questions seem to be answered.
All right. I want to come back to you in just a minute, Lee, to talk mm-hmm. about what's left in the final week of session. But Stephanie, this riot boosting bill is also still something that we're following. Tell me a little bit about what Governor Kristi Noem's bill intends to do.
Yeah, right. So this is her bill that repeals, replaces, it updates certain provisions of our state's riot statutes. It is a little bit closer to making it to her desk. Last week, it had a hearing in Senate Judiciary. It was actually a late evening hearing, as there were a lot of folks that wanted to testify either for or against it. Her office was there to lay out the merits of the bill. Katie Huruska with the governor's office talked about the three main things that the bill will do.
It replaces the incitement crime in a way that preserves everyone's constitutional rights of free speech and peaceful assembly. Second, it is in response to the federal court order, and it strikes certain provisions in South Dakota law. Third, the bill protects our people and their property by keeping them safe by the narrowest means necessary.
All right. Law enforcement speaks in favor of this bill. Tell us a little bit about that.
They did. There were several folks representing law enforcement. Kevin Tome, he's our Pennington County Sheriff. He was in Pierre and testified to lawmakers and asked them to approve the bill.
In our area, we periodically have protests, marches, rallies, and frankly, it spans across all ideologies. When that happens, then the burden falls on us as law enforcement to strike that balance between people that are exercising their First Amendment rights and maintaining a peaceful event and keeping everybody safe, and frankly, keeping peace in the community at large. I feel this bill gives us in law enforcement an additional tool to do our jobs effectively.
And Stephanie says they're all ideologies, but certainly tribal communities have had much to say about this and have pointed out that it can feel very personal. Did tribal officials speak out?
They did. Lester Thompson with the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe was there telling lawmakers, we already have laws in place to protect people and property from violent protesting, disorderly conduct, trespassing, inciting a riot, telling lawmakers he feels that this law criminalizes protesters because of their intent to protest. And he says it's already been deemed unconstitutional last year. And even though it has been written, he did not hold back. He still opposes the bill and questions its constitutionality.
It has been recently reworded slightly to try to address those unconstitutional ruling. You can sugarcoat a turd to make it easier to swallow. In the end, it's still a turd.
There's our quote of the week.
Yeah.
All right. What did he ask for next?
Well, he really decided to take a look back at Americans' history and asked lawmakers to look at the Boston Tea Party and why protesters protested early in our country's history.
Does the Boston Tea Party ring a bell with you? Why did those during that time take action of protest? They did not agree with what was taking place and thus were being oppressed. On the formation of this country and its constitution, those incidents there help inspire the First Amendment. To attack the fundamentals of the United States, which this law does, is the most unpatriotic act you can do. It is very sad to see a day when those who were being oppressed become the oppressors.
What happened to that measure?
So out of committee, it was given a green light, 6-1. It was then debated on the Senate floor later last week, and it also passed 27-8. So it's gone through both chambers and should be making its way to the governor's desk.
All right, Lee Strubinger, I want to get to all of you and ask you what's next, because this is the final week of session. But we'll start with Lee. Tell us what the week looks like, Lee.
Sure. So right now, both the House and Senate are technically gaveled in, but they're in recess until a little bit later, probably about 20 minutes. We'll see. And they're going through any remaining bills that haven't been decided on. Both the House and Senate have quite a laundry list of bills left to consider. So they could be working on those well into the evening.
All right. And they meet until Thursday, as I understand it. If they clear the calendars today, how do they spend the rest of that week?
So mostly budget negotiations on some of that one-time spending I mentioned earlier, you know, and they'll also spend the next 3 days considering bills that might have changed in their respective chambers. So if a bill passed out of the House and the Senate amended it, you know, those bills will kind of cross back into their house of origin. And then that chamber will either approve it, or if they disagree on it, we'll go into what's called a conference committee, where both houses have technically approved a bill, but one disagrees with the changes. So then they'll kind of come together to sort of iron out those changes. And that'll kind of be how the next 3 days kind of look.
Seth Tupper, things that you are looking for as we wind into this last week, go careening into this last week, as it were.
One of the main things I'm watching is a trio of bills that's meant to deal with 40 orphan natural gas wells up near Buffalo in the northwest corner of the state. And those have had a pretty good run, but they're not quite finished yet. There's a bill to raise the minimum bond requirement for wells from a low of $10,000 per well right now to a minimum of $50,000 per well. That still needs the governor's signature. And then there's another bill that would allow essentially environmental regulators to take money from leftover bond money from one project and use it to do a cleanup on another project. That has been passed and has been signed by the governor. But there's a third bill that would specifically appropriate about $727,000 to plug those wells up by Buffalo. And that has passed the Senate, but still needs action by the House.
Is that the only thing that would deal with the problem now? And the rest of it is looking to avoiding this problem in the future of these orphaned natural gas wells?
Yeah, actually, the bill to allow leftover bond money to be captured from other projects That is specifically because there is a project out there. There was a wildcat oil well drilled near Wasta, where some of the bond money was never used, and they want to capture that money to also apply to plug these wells. So I think there was over $100,000 available there. So, so it's that's for both. That would also help for future situations, but is needed now as well.
Interesting. All right. You also talked to us recently about guns in county courthouses, and we told the backstory of how that kind of came to be. What happened to that legislation? Do we know yet?
And that is still pending. So that has passed the House, or excuse me, the Senate and a House committee. And that is another one of those bills that the House needs to act on, again, to allow county employees to carry guns in courthouses where now they basically can't unless they have specific permission from the county commission.
All right. And we're still waiting to hear about search and rescue costs in the Badlands, too, right?
Yeah, that's a bill that would allow it. The testimony basically dealt with the Interior Volunteer Fire Department and all the costs they incur doing rescues and other operations on Badlands National Park and also in the Buffalo Gap National Grasslands. And this bill would allow them to basically send a bill for up to $1,000 to people that they rescue on federal land to try to help them with some of those costs. And that has passed both chambers and is on the governor's desk right now.
All right. Jackie Hendry, anything you're watching this last week particularly closely?
Still more money at stake for a lot of projects. We've got funding at stake for a statewide 211 program out of those mental health related summer studies over the last couple of years. Now seeing if we can put our money where our mouth is in some ways on that system. Also looking at some one-time funds for some of those state institutions, library renovations, money for a new health sciences center at the University of South Dakota, and seeing if the legislature will pass needs-based scholarship funding.
Interesting. Stephanie Rissler, anything you have your eye on particularly closely this week?
You know, some of the things my colleagues have mentioned, I'm keeping an eye on, but really that final appropriations bill and what entities receive what when it's all said and done.
All right. Lee Strubinger, any final thoughts here? Are we good?
I think we're good.
All right. We covered a lot, and lawmakers certainly have a lot to cover as well for Jackie Hendry and Stephanie Rissler, Lee Strubinger, and Seth Tupper. We'll see you next time.
You can keep up with the top legislative news every day by listening to the 2020 Statehouse podcast. For additional programming and news, listen to us online at sdpb.org. Be sure to download the free SD.net app on your mobile device for live committee meetings, floor sessions, and daily archives of the People's Business and Peer. Be sure to connect with us on social media by liking the SDPB News Facebook page and following at SDPB News on Twitter. Funding is provided in part by SDN Communications, the South Dakota Bar Foundation, Missouri River Energy Services, and Touchstone Energy Cooperative. This has been a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.